talking a lot about that. People leaving things in their medicine cabinets. Somebody, you know, kind of trolling around the house uses them for the wrong purposes. Now, we've got Mark Estrin with us, PhD, holds doctorates in psychology and English. He has a radio show, Report on Medicine. His latest book, kind of turning the whole conundrum on its ear, telling us that there are a lot of people out there who actually need to control pain.
That's right, Larry. Now, you've been dealing a lot with politicians, and you understand how it works in the political arena. The drug problem is a very real one, and it's a very serious one. It injures people. It kills people. There is no question that there is serious drug abuse and that it needs to be dealt with. But as you know from all your dealings with politicians, what government can do well and what government cannot do well are two very different things. Government cannot handle things simply. That's not possible. And government is not very good at nuance. Government is good with using a kind of meat axe approach to whatever problems may be going on. And that's essentially what's gone on in the attempt to deal with prescription drug abuse and drug abuse in general. Government is very good at enforcement, but it's not very good at figuring out which people really deserve to have the enforcement taken against them. And that's a very serious issue when it comes to prescription drug abuse. There's a very simple example here. There are a certain number of very dedicated pharmacists who have made it a point to try to deal with people who have chronic, unremitting pain and therefore need opioid painkillers on an ongoing basis. It's a subspecialty within pharmacy, and it's a very important one, and it's very tightly regulated, as it should be. But under the impetus of a need for additional crackdowns, and that's a word you frequently hear when it comes to drug abuse issues, more crackdowns on the use of drugs that are subject to abuse, what has happened is the Drug Enforcement Administration in particular has put a clampdown on the suppliers of the drugs to the pharmacists who specialize in management of people with chronic pain. They don't go after the pharmacists directly. They go after the companies that supply them with what they need in order to dispense the material for the people with chronic pain. Well, what that means is that they can't get the medicines because their reports show that a very large percentage of their business involves the dispensing of opioids. And when you go back through the government machinery here, what you discover is the government says, wait a minute, normally a pharmacy only dispenses, for the sake of argument, 10% of its medication involves opioids. Here's a pharmacy that's doing 75%. They must be part of the problem of illegal drugs, which isn't the case at all. Now, that's where you get into the problem, because the only way government can analyze this is by things like statistical measures. They can't get down into the real issues of pain management and how do you deal with a doctor-patient relationship, which the government clearly can't do, as we already know from the Affordable Care Act. It's a very difficult problem. Well, I'll tell you, if you look at one of the best sources of this kind of information is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The CDC has actually made a statement on this, which is a very reasonable statement. And they say, persons who abuse opioids have learned to exploit the new practitioner sensitivity to patient pain. And clinicians struggle to treat patients without overprescribing these drugs. And that speaks exactly to what you were just saying, Larry, that it's a very difficult line to draw because doctors want to ameliorate pain. They want to make people feel better. They understand that. There is no better way of doing that than by prescribing opioids carefully, carefully. And the key there is carefully. But 80% of people who are prescribed opioids are prescribed low doses by a single practitioner. And the government doesn't argue with this. These people account for maybe 20% of prescription drug overdoses, and frequently that's just because they really were in a lot of pain and they took two when they were supposed to take one, and that's a prescription drug overdose. The real problem is that there are about 10% of people who do what's called doctor shopping, which means they try to get care from multiple doctors and they end up with high daily doses because they're prescribed by multiple people and they fill them at a lot of different pharmacies, and the pharmaceutical the pharmaceuticals are not that well connected yet in terms of electronic connection of healthcare, so they're able to get these things and they use more than they should, and that's really a major issue. And that's the issue, reasonably, that's where this ought to be drawn. That is where you ought to be drawing the line and watching for it. But that is a nuanced problem, and it's a difficult one for government to deal with because it requires nuance and care in the dealing with it. That's correct. And in fact, collateral damage is exactly what ends up with these people end up being. You know, the government has gotten into this before. The government's been there before. We're finally beginning to have a discussion in this country about mental health issues, which trace back to largely because of the amount of gun violence that we've seen recently from people who clearly have mental health issues. And without getting into the whole discussion about gun ownership and gun registration and all that, which is a whole separate issue, the people who have been responsible for the shootings that we've been hearing about so much and that disturb everybody so much, these are people who clearly have mental issues of one kind or another. Well, the government is largely responsible for the deinstitutionalization of people with mental problems and for the fact that so many of them are out on the streets because there's nowhere for them to go. Because in a well-intentioned attempt to end the warehousing of people in mental, what were then called mental institutions, dating back to around the 1960s, a well-intentioned attempt, it didn't work. It wasn't funded properly. There was a result that a lot of the institutions, there are very few mental, what would now be called mental hospitals, inpatient mental facilities. Very, very few of them. They're very expensive to run. The insurers don't want to insure that, with the exception of a very few, like the Menninger Clinic in Houston is one of the very few in the United States that still exist. And this is deliberate on the part of the government, trying to do good by getting rid of institutions that were undoubtedly difficult and inhumane and had all kinds of abuses associated with them. But the unintended consequence was that people were put out on the street, and basically they were supposed to take medication that would control their mental difficulties. Well, that's fine, but you can't force them to take the medication because they're not in an institution where someone's making sure they take it. So as a result, right, and anybody, and I'll tell you, Larry, anybody who thinks that jail is a better place for someone with mental difficulties than what used to be called a mental institution really needs to think again, because that certainly doesn't work for anybody involved. Well, what it tells me is that, and I am trained as a psychologist, and I tend to look at this from a psychological standpoint. What it tells me is that no matter how well-intentioned the rules and the laws may be, it still falls to each individual to try to make decisions for himself or herself about what is needed in terms of medical care. We've had a lot of arguments over the years, particularly in recent years, about so-called rationing of medical care. The fact is, we have always had rationing of medical care, not because it's an insurance basis, not because of a government basis. We've always had it because people themselves are either more or less inclined to seek help for various problems that they may have. And this is a particular issue when it comes to something like pain. You must know people, Larry, who have higher or lower pain tolerance than you do. One of the first things you learn in medical studies is that pain is not an objective symptom. It is subjective. And even if we can measure, and in many ways we can now, even if we can measure the pain impulses traveling along our nerves, the fact that we can see two people have equal impulses doesn't mean that they are perceiving those impulses the same way. So somebody might be able to tolerate pain much better than somebody else, and therefore one of those people will need more opioids if the pain is chronic from, let's say, arthritis, for example. One person may need more medication, the other may need less medication. Same people, same diagnosis, same apparent pain. This is why physicians have to be allowed to use their own judgment to figure out what's required. But to the extent that they're constantly being forced to look over their shoulders and think, wait a minute, if I write too many prescriptions for pain medicine, the DEA is going to come after me, and all of a sudden I'm going to find myself and my practice criminalized. That by itself is a criminal thing to do, because you're not only what it tells you is this: the Affordable Care Act, which like all laws, it has pluses and minuses, and when you cut through all the political elements of it, of which there are many, it has good intentions. Whether or not those good intentions will be fulfilled, we aren't going to know for years. But what it's telling you is that medicine is moving toward a standardized model. That's what's happening. When you have something like the Affordable Care Act mandating a certain approach to the way doctors talk to patients, you will find that whatever doctor you may go to will be more likely to ask you similar questions, unless the doctor is able to get the information from your electronic medical records, which is also part of the ACA. The whole idea is to make sure that medical practitioners know essentially the same things about essentially everybody. And yes, that is subject to abuse. Yes, there's a level of record keeping that understandably worries some people. Yes, it means that something you say to one person and then later decide was wrong may be in your permanent medical record, and you may be identified as a high risk person for one, not necessarily a disease, but something mental, for example. So yes, there are risks, but at the same time, the attempt is to standardize medical care across a wide variety of geographic areas and a wide variety of specialties. Will it work? That's what we're not going to know for years, because, again, from a psychologist's point of view, I see every single person as totally different, not just in terms of pain tolerance, but in terms of the way the person handles any kind of illness or setback. And I'm not so sure that a standardized model like that is going to work across the board, although it may work in terms of some fairly straightforward diagnoses, and that's really what it's aimed at. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.